$680 million poured into precision ag last year. Autonomous weeding robots dominated, and John Deere made two acquisitions in 3 months. A food company, not an equipment maker, bought a robotics startup to protect its own supply chain. The deals are accelerating, the money is moving, and the winners are already separating from the pack. If you're investing, building, or buying in this space, you need the full picture before your competitors get it. The 2025 Precision Agriculture Intelligence Report from iGrowNews is now available. Get your copy today at igrownews.com/precision.
One of the things that's interesting is to follow trends and inputs, and that applies to patents as it applies to activity on social media, for instance. If you have a company that for a certain period of time continuously applies for patents, and there is this sort of patent activity of them just continuously applying and being granted or redoing these patent applications and so on, and then all of a sudden there's nothing for like 3-4 years, then that's a signal for things that may have happened. It doesn't mean that they went bankrupt. It doesn't mean that nothing's happening. It doesn't mean that they're out of business. It may mean that they were acquired, or it may mean that they just have their technology. They're currently on a commercialization process, but it's definitely one signal to follow. The same way that if you have a company that continuously posts on social media and all of a sudden they don't post for a month or two, that can mean that something's happening.
Welcome to the Vertical Farming Podcast, weekly conversations with fascinating CEOs, founders, and ag tech visionaries. Join us every week as we dive deep into the world of vertical farming with your host, Harry Duran.
A quick update to share the announcement of Greenhouse Success Stories, the latest podcast from the iGrowNews Podcast Network. Every week, we share conversations with growers, operators, and innovators from around the world, providing insight to what's working in their greenhouses. We discuss firsthand experiences and provide insights into how these farms are succeeding and thriving. We're grateful for the support of our title sponsor, Arnott Greenhouse. The show is hosted by Trina Semenchuk, founder of Little Greenhouse That Could. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to your favorite show. Visit greenhousesuccess.com to learn more. So David Sandelman, CEO of Canachol, thank you so much for joining me on the Vertical Farming Podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Great being with you. Good to see you again.
Yeah, likewise. So for the benefit of the viewers and the listener, where's home for you?
We're here in Vermont, but we also have an office in Denver.
So thanks to the outreach from your PR team, we got to connect at Indoor AgCon. So I'm wondering how the rest of the conference went for you and if there was any insights or how much value you got from being there on the ground.
Indoor Ag was great because what we are exposed to other people that have different products in post-harvest. And so they're like, we can use this technology. And we've also been, you know, playing with the idea of getting more involved, using our technology to maintain proper VPD, vapor pressure deficit in grow. But, you know, our main emphasis was on post-harvest of various different products. And every day we're learning that there's new and exciting things. We just did a trial with someone trying saffron.
Okay.
Someone's been doing testing, and we even use it at home for our own herbs that we grow for storage. It's great. We did a facility in Hawaii that does seaweed.
Yeah, we'll get into all of those specifics because I remember you taking us through that. What I want to do is wind the clock back a little bit because your story doesn't actually begin in cannabis. It begins in a restaurant. So
yeah,
take us back. You know, what were you doing all those years ago, and what was the problem that you stumbled into?
Yeah. So being here in Vermont, my wife and I are corporate refugees, left the big city, came up to Vermont, wound up in a inn and restaurant, and our mission was buying local. So 20-something years ago, we were at the cutting edge of farm to table, and we worked with a lot of local cheesemakers. And it was there that we learned that the cheesemakers were struggling with their aging rooms. And digging into it and trying to understand what the issues were, it was like, well, yeah, cheese is very regional. It's climate and geology specific, the herds, what they're feeding, all of that. And now people were here in Vermont trying to make any kind of cheese any time of the year. And it was like, wait, you know, you used to make cheddar in Cheddar England, and you made Romano in Emilia Romano, and you're trying to make this cheese in Vermont. And what was unique, it was those cheese were made and then stored in caves in the area, which was cool, and that's where they did the aging. You can't dig a cave in Vermont. It's granite. It's solid. You go down a couple of feet, and that's it. You hit rock. Yeah. You hit rock bottom. And so then it was getting to the, what's unique about a cave?
Yeah.
And then it became, oh, it's all about consistent, very consistent conditions. And, you know, people speak about humidity, and it's like, well, humidity is really made up of what's the temperature in the cave. Mm-hmm. And what's the moisture content in the cave? And those two are extremely stable. Mm. So that became, okay, how do we create an environment with very stable temperature and very stable vapor pressure, dew point? And that's what led to the development of Vapetrol. And so we built a couple of cheese facilities here, you know, retrofit their rooms, and they had great success. And word spread, and we were working with someone who was a consultant in the cheese industry, and then he took the technology and deployed it in all over U.S. and Canada, and cheesemakers all over were winning ribbons at the cheese competition that had our technology. They also would come back to us and say, you know, I can sleep at night. I don't have to go out there and check on my cheese and make sure I don't have a problem. And so that's how it all began. From there, it went to charcuterie.
I'm curious about the cheese. What was it about your background that helped you understand the specificity of these environments that maybe other people were missing?
So my background was and has been controls. I have many patents, and the very first patent I got was late 70s, early 80s during the first energy crisis, a digital clock thermostat. It was the first digital clock thermostat. It's the whole category today. You go into a Home Depot and there's a whole section of digital clock thermostats. But what was developed was the first digital clock thermostat. And what was unique at the time is most homes at that time had what we call a hockey puck, a round thermostat on the wall. Yeah. You turned it up and down. And it only had two wires. And so the challenge was, how do you run a clock and how do you have the thermostat turn the heat on and off?
Yeah.
So we're able to do both sending power to the thermostat and sending the signal from the thermostat to the heat. That's what was unique, and it was the first digital clock thermostat. So my background's always been in various types of controls.
You talk a lot, and I want to make sure if we get to in the technical weeds that we can bring it and simplify it for folks, because there's a lot of things we're talking about here that are important, and especially for indoor farming. You talk a lot about stability versus just temperature. Can you explain that difference in simple terms?
Sure. So a lot of people are trying to control the relative humidity in a space, whether it's post-harvest or even in a grow room. And the challenge is relative humidity is not a controllable variable. It is made up of two components. What's the temperature of the air and what's the amount of moisture in the air, which is measured in either vapor pressure or dew point. If you know dew point, you know vapor pressure. If you know vapor pressure, you know dew point. But those are the two variables that make up what relative humidity is. So if you change the temperature, the relative humidity changes. If you change the amount of moisture in the air, the relative humidity changes. So controlling relative humidity directly really doesn't exist as mathematical or science. And best example I like to use is a bank loan, right? You get a monthly payment. And if you want to increase or decrease your monthly payment, there's no dial to turn up and down your monthly payment. You got to change the term of the loan, the interest of the loan, or the principal of the loan. Change any one of those three and your monthly payment changes. But there's no such thing as a dial to dial up and dial down your monthly payment. Relative humidity is the same thing. So while people are, oh, I'm trying to control the relative humidity, well, it's nearly impossible because one of two variables change. And then what happens is they use equipment like air conditioners. And an air conditioner, when you turn it on, does two things. It cools the air and dries the air. And so both of the components that make relative humidity are shifting, or they introduce dehumidifiers. A dehumidifier removes moisture from the air, so it's lowering the vapor pressure dew point, but at the same time, it's raising the temperature of the air. So there's this conflict. And very often, if you've got a room that you have air conditioners and dehumidifiers, the dehumidifier comes on to remove moisture from the air. And while it's doing that, yeah, it's removing moisture, but it's also warming the air.
So they're in competition with each other.
Yeah, now the air conditioner goes, hey, wait, it's starting to get warm in here. I'm going to come on to cool the air. But guess what? It's also removing moisture. And then the relative, the dehumidifier is like, wait, the air is getting drier than I want it. I'm going to turn off. Yeah. And so you wind up in this crazy dance of the air conditioners, the dehumidifiers. Now, what you might see is a fairly stable relative humidity and people are claiming success. But what's really happening in the space is the vapor pressure is going up and down as these pieces of equipment are cycling on and off because the temperature is doing things simultaneously, which sort of caused a flat line of relative humidity. But what we learned is plants, they don't care about the relative humidity. They're interested in the two components. What's the temperature and what's the vapor pressure? Because in growing, people talk about VPD, the vapor pressure difference, and that is the difference of the vapor pressure at the leaf surface and the vapor pressure in the room. When they're close, the water, the vapor that's coming out of the stomata or the leaf is not drawn away fast enough because the vapor difference is too close. And so things can get moist under a leaf, and that's where start getting mold, critters, and things you don't want because it's a nice moist area. On the other side.
And when you have all those systems clocking on and off, it's obviously a lot of expenditure and energy as well. So
absolutely, because they're counteracting each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
On the other side, if your vapor pressure difference is too great, now what happens is the plant is losing moisture quickly. So it starts bringing up moisture up through the roots at a faster rate. Well, that means it's bringing up the nutrients at a faster rate. And now you can wind up overfeeding, poisoning the plant with too much nutrients.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so if your vapor pressure in the room is doing this, the poor plant is like, whoa, which way do you want me to go? And they're looking at, oh, but we're holding a flat relative humidity.
Sure.
So
that's a good explanation. Thank you for that. So you solved it for cheese, and you were about to mention how that turned into charcuterie and dry aged steak.
Yeah. So, you know, what it came down to is holding a constant vapor pressure in the space to remove the free available water. And with shelf-stable products, they're looking for a 0.6 water activity. At a 0.6 water activity, molds and microbes can't grow. And it's a unit of measure that expresses how much water is bound and unbound in the product.
Okay.
And it is the unbound water that things grow on and feed on, the mold, the microbes. Mm-hmm. And once you get to a 0.6 water activity, there no longer is enough unbound water for them to survive. And that's how you...
How would you define unbound water, the concept of that?
That is water that's not bound up in cellular structure.
Okay.
It's free available.
Okay.
So it's just there for other things to grab onto and feed. Once you get rid of that, it's still in the product, but the microbes and mold can't get to it to feed. And then you have a shelf-stable product. So take cheese or charcuterie, the same thing. You know, what they're after is they want, those are about shelf-stable products.
Yeah.
And then you get USDA, FDA, they want to know what the water activity of that product is. So they know when the consumer gets it, it's going to be shelf-stable. And not when you cut into that salami, it's rancid in the middle because there was still unbound water for microbes to grow on. They use other salts and other things to help the process for shelf stability. But being involved in the food industry and learning about water activity, bound and unbound water, it was like, wait a second, a cannabis flower.
Yeah.
Why are they trying the cannabis flower? Well, you can't smoke it when it's freshly picked. It's too wet. It won't burn. And if you try and store it, it's going to go moldy. So people dry it.
Yeah.
But now we've learned about the science of shelf stability and what's really going on. So that's when we said, hey, let's apply this technology, the Vapotrol technology, which we called it, to a cannabis flower and see what happens. Our first challenge was no one was going to give us a giant room, a flower to play with, you know, because everything we did was on a large scale for cheesemakers, charcuterie makers. You know, it's big rooms with thousands and thousands of pounds of product in there that's drying. So we realized no one's going to give us that much flower to play with, nor did we know what the outcome was. So that's when we built a prototype and we purchased a wine cooler and stripped it out, just used the insulated box with the door and put a couple of thousand dollars worth of controls on it, gave it to a grower and said, put some flour in there and tell us what happens. Is it going to destroy it? It does nothing. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, he's like, I don't know what this box is, but this is some of the finest flour I've ever produced. He's like hanging on to it. I'm not going to give it back. And that's when we knew we were on to something.
How long did that process take for him to see that result?
It was like a week or two, because you get, you know, smokable flour in about 8 days.
Okay.
But interesting, you know, we've always said, oh, about 8 days. But as now there's more and more of this technology out there, more and more people are using it. Yeah. We're starting to learn a lot of interesting things, because now there's a reference standard. It's repeatable and consistent. So now you can do experiments, because at least you know the dry cure is always going to be the same.
Okay.
And so what's come out of this is now people are starting to see that different cultivars need different amounts of time until they're optimum and they're at their peak. So early on, we said, 4 days will get you to your 0.6 water activity, and you like to see another 4 days before you got a nice smokable product. But once we started getting to a broad global audience, people, well, you ruined my flower. I had it in there 8 days. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And then we started learning, oh, that cultivar might need 30 days. Now, all of a sudden, we're like, oh, you know what? We're not much different than the wine industry, than the cheese industry, and Brejeut, you know?
Yeah.
This, you pay a premium for longer age Brejeut than young Brejeut.
And
a wine. Certain wines age better over time. Not all. Guess what? Cultivar specific. Now people are starting to learn the same thing applies to cannabis. It's an agricultural product, and cultivar to cultivars different take different time.
You also mentioned trichomes. Can you explain what those are and why preserving them is so critical?
Well, you know, just like you grow a vineyard and you have your grapes and you squeeze, you know, you're going after the juice in the grape in a cannabis plant. The trichome is where the THC and CBDs and terpenes and all of those are produced. They're these little bulbous glands. They're on the ends of stalks. A lot of people have seen trichome pictures. Mm-hmm. Pretty much all plants have trichomes. Even a lemon zest, you know, you're breaking into the outer trichome. And the trichomes in plants are a defense mechanism in multiple ways, different fronts, different plants. But part of it is the terpenes are good because they smell, and certain predators, bugs, whatever, might not like that smell. And so when the little trichome heads burst, the little exploding bombs, the predator who touches it goes, this is nasty, and leaves. Also, it's sticky, and they might get trapped there, and they're done. So they're also, on the cannabis plant, are known to protect the plant from UV light. It's sort of like a whole forest of little sunscreen things there. But what do we grow the plant for? We want to harvest what's in the trichome heads, whether we smoke it, whether we press it, whether we extract it. But that's where it is. Now, what we're learning So it started with, we did that first unit and it was like, wow, this is some of the best flower I've ever produced. And then did another and another, and everyone kept coming back. This is amazing. The flower smokes amazing. It's not over dry. It's consistent. It tastes great. So the first thing we did is we went out and did some side-by-side analytics and saw that our terpenes were much higher than the way people were conventionally drying and curing using air conditioners, dehumidifiers, hanging in a barn, hanging in the basement, whatever.
We were
consistently higher in terpenes.
Which is also a bonus.
Yeah,
for cannabis.
So then we're like, well, why? And so then we started doing the research on the whys. And it took quite a bit of time. But ultimately, what we learned is when you try with conventional methods, the little trichome heads, which are called the cuticles, ruptured. And that was where the loss of the terpenes and everything was going. And we did it two different ways. The researchers, one, first stumbled upon this by doing grid counts under a microscope, using Vapetrol technology for drying flower, compared to conventional like 60-60 method of drying. And they're like, wow, 25 to 30% of the trichome heads are ruptured conventional, and only 1 to 2% of them are ruptured using the Vapetrol technology. Then they reapproached it using chromophotography, knowing that ruptured trichomes change in color. And that backed up what the grid counts were.
Okay.
So now we knew we have higher terpene retention because of the non-rupturing of the trichome heads. Now, that raises the next question, the next why.
Yeah.
Okay. And what we don't know yet is whether the trichome heads are rupturing because in conventional systems, the vapor pressure is fluctuating up and down. And is that causing the trichome head to flex? Every time the vapor pressure goes down around it, it expands. The vapor pressure around it goes up, it contracts. And is that fluctuating vapor pressure causing stress fractures, because it's only two cell walls thick to break, or we're maintaining a constant stable vapor pressure? Is it allowing the cuticle, those two cell walls, to either harden or ripen? We really don't know, or a combination of both.
And you're able to do the measurement of tracking, or maybe not yet, of the vapor pressure as it fluctuates same time?
Yes.
At the same time while you're looking at the cell walls?
That we haven't gotten to.
Okay. All right.
Okay. We haven't. Yeah. This is only the results.
Yeah.
That it's subject to fluctuation or constant over a period of days.
So you're still doing, so further testing is continuing.
Every day we're gutting further and further into it. In the past, in legacy, there was dry was a step, then cure. And well, why? Well, because if you put it in a barn, if you put it in a room with air conditioning or dehumidifiers, it's constantly going to dry. The water's going to keep leaving it.
Sure.
And you're going to wind up with overdried dust. So at some point, you got to make the call and say, it's dry enough, and move it into some sealed containers to arrest the drying process. And up until now, that has been a touchy-feely, you know, snap the stems. Because if you don't
go by instinct,
you're gonna overdry it. So you gotta then put it in jars or totes or bags or turkey bags.
So the curing is essentially halting the drying process.
You're removing it from the drying area to stop the drying process.
Yeah.
But then what's happening there? Well, people would move out of the drying space, and if they took it out too soon, if the big coalers still had unbound water in it, where the smaller didn't, and they put it in a sealed vessel, well, they might get mold because they haven't dried it sufficiently. So what do? Mm. They burp. They open the jar to let out that extra moisture. But I ask them, but in Florida in August, you open the jar, which way is the water going? Out of the jar or into the jar? Versus Minnesota in January, where the air is so bone dry, that flower might be perfectly dried. You're going to open the jar, and whatever moisture you have left in there, you're going to let out and then seal it, and the flower is going to further dry.
I'm in Minnesota, so I can vouch for that.
Right, exactly. But what we're doing, by holding the vapor pressure constant, there's no ending the drying process.
Yeah.
The flower comes to equilibrium with the vapor pressure in the space and just stays there. So you no longer have to move it.
Okay.
You don't have to. And so now drying is a continuum right into cure and store.
Yeah.
You okay, eliminate that labor, you eliminate the guesswork. We like to say it's sous vide for weed.
Oh, anyone in the restaurant industry would know about the sous vide. So, yeah.
Right, because it doesn't matter if you got a little steak or a big steak, you put them into the tank of water at your finished temperature, they both get there and are in equilibrium, and you can leave them there. They don't get overcooked.
Yeah.
We're doing the same thing with vapor pressure with a flour.
That's great. So what was interesting is that I imagine this results in higher yield, better quality, longer shelf life, like all of the above.
Yeah. All of the above. A reduction in labor. And then that all turns into, well, okay, higher yield, that interests people. Because we'll go into a facility and measure their current flour that they're shipping and seeing they're drying it to maybe a 0.5 water activity instead of 0.6. And they're walking away 5 to 7% of their top line revenue by over drying. And a lot of them are doing that because they're concerned about mold.
Yeah.
So they're willing to sacrifice all that revenue, knowingly or unknowingly.
Yeah. So when you're having these conversations and you're heading into these meeting with these farmers and these growers, is it like a light bulb moment for them? What's the real world impact that it's having?
What's interesting is to see the nodding heads as you explain the challenges of pulling it out of the dry room, and someone goes in there on Friday and goes, wow, you know, if we leave it till Monday, it's going to be over dry, but we can't pull it now. Do we bring people in over the weekend? Do we leave it? You know, and then all of a sudden it's like, that's no longer a discussion. It's no longer an issue. Just leave it there till Thursday, Friday, whenever. If you follow the sous vide example, higher yield. Yeah, that drops right to the bottom line. You spent the money on energy, labor, your genetics, your nutrient, all your overheads are paid, and now you have an opportunity to pick up another 5 to 7%, depending on how much you're overdrying the flour.
That makes
and
a difference.
Then more important is the quality of the flour.
Yeah.
You know, the industry has been going through a race to the bottom, and look at the beer world 40, 50 years ago. When you had the Budweisers and the Pabst Blue Ribbons and, just the major beers. And then came about craft beer. And quickly, guess what? A consumer today will pay more for 4 cans of beer than they will for a whole suitcase of Budweiser.
Of course, yeah.
All right? And so, yes, the consumer is willing to pay a premium price for a quality product. But you need to deliver a quality product. You just can't say it's a quality product. And when you deliver it, when they come back for more, it's got to be the same quality product. And with conventional systems, there's too many variabilities because of what time of year is it has a great impact on their dry rooms, where we give them consistent product year-round no matter what the climate is. So all of a sudden, now you can start seeing the Coca-Cola model for the MSOs. So someone who's growing and using our tech for dry cure in Florida will be able to deliver exactly the same product in Denver, Colorado, which is known for Colorado Crunch.
That's huge. It seems like obviously like a lot of agriculture is still operating on a tradition of approximation and using traditional tactics. And we're moving to a world where everything is becoming controlled and predictable.
Yes. Yeah. And that's key, is getting proper control over it. A lot of people think they have control, but really when you dig into it, it's a false sense of having control when you really start digging into the numbers and graphing what's going on with the vapor pressure in the space, what's going on with the temperature in the space.
A lot of it is dependent. If you think about the wine industry and cheese industry, you know, people who probably have tons of experience or just a nose, an olfactory sense that is like way above, you know, normal, or the people that work in the perfume industry, like they have this sense of smell, so they can operate on instinct because their senses are so heightened. But that's not the case, and you can't really replicate that because it's dependent on one person.
That's an amazing point. And you know, you talk about the person at facilities that turn out really good flower, and they're the person that says, okay, it's dry enough.
Yeah.
Let's arrest the drying process and move it to cure. And I equate that to someone who's on the line cooking steaks at a steakhouse. And he's been there for years. And every steak goes out exactly the way the customer wants it. Medium well, medium rare, rare, you name it. He never misses. And then he gets sick one day. And they grab the guy on the dish line and say, stand here, put the steaks on the grill. And then there's, if you know, in the restaurant world, it's like you point to your hand, and if the steak feels like this, it's medium. Yeah, the thumb test, right. Well, guess what? Probably more than half the steaks are going to come back.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're not cooked right. Yeah. So, yeah, it can be done. But then you're depending on this one person.
Yeah.
Versus
single point of failure. Yeah.
Back to sous vide, you put them in, they're going to be cooked exactly to the right temperature. Not that sous vide is a substitute for what you can do on a grill, but you get the concept there. That's right.
So, at Indoor AgCon, you know, obviously, as you were moving and explaining the benefits for the cannabis space, were you able to have conversations with other growers? Do you see applications or are people interested in doing this? Are there other crops that are coming up? I'm curious what your insights were, what those conversations were like at the conference.
Yeah, one that we'd love to find someone to work with is hops.
Okay.
Turns out hops and the cannabis plant are very closely related. You know, when you start understanding terpene profiles, there's many beers, if you take a good smell, you're like, oh, that's got a lot of cannabis terpene notes and stuff like that. And the hops has a lot of terpenes in it. But what is the industry doing now to dry hops? Mm-hmm. They're heating it. And terpenes boil off at fairly low temperature. So they're probably boiling off a good chunk of the terpenes in hops. And so what we're trying to do is find someone that we can work with that's willing to take a batch of hops, dry it with our technology, and make some beer with it. Now, what might turn out is people go, this beer is disgusting, because they never had beer with that many terpenes retained in the hops.
Yeah,
or the other side might be, oh my, I've never had a beer this good. This is amazing, because they never had a beer that was able to express all the terpenes that were originally in the hops.
Yeah.
We don't know which way it's going to go, but it's definitely worth a try.
What was your take on the indoor farming, the broader indoor farming industry, from seeing all the vendors there and, you know, all the challenges people are having? And obviously, there's been a lot of news about failures in the space. And I think because people were coming at it from a technology play as opposed to realizing, hey, it's actually, you're a farmer, you need to grow.
Yes.
And you need to have a crop that's profitable. So I'm curious what your take on the overall industry was.
Wait, you know, I was walking around because, you know, we're doing all this work on vapor pressure, VPD on the grow side, and quickly learn the space is pretty crowded with people bringing in controls into the space.
Yeah.
And I think there is a gap between, as you said, the farmer growing it and the people who are doing controls. And very often, that control thought process background comes out of the comfort, cooling and heating side of the world.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the industry, the bulk of equipment sold, air conditioners, dehumidifiers, they've always been built and designed for comfort cooling. And then now people are modifying them for indoor ag, greenhouse, that type of thing, instead of taking a whole new approach as, okay, what is the process requirements? And that's what makes us unique, is we are a process system that's designed for the process of getting your product to the right water activity for shelf stability versus applying conventional comfort cooling equipment to accomplish it, because, well, we had the discussion with air conditioning all over the place and dehumidifier. No, we're, you know, what our technology was developed and does is gives, and our patents are about, is independent control of what's called latent and sensible heat. Sensible heat is the temperature of the air. Latent heat is the amount of moisture in the air. Conventional air conditioners and dehumidifiers have a fixed sensible latent ratio, or can be moved slightly. We give independent control of the two, so you can really zero in on what the plants need or what the product that you're doing post-harvest needs.
You also hinted at something bigger, layering AI on top of this environmental control. What would that unlock?
It's going to, and what we're looking at is the AI to analyze what the plants are doing as a feedback for the control system.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's still a little early, because First, we have to get the controls in place and working, and then you use AI to tune it in the end.
Do you see a future where these environments are essentially self-optimized based on the crop?
Yes, it will get there. But like anything else over the years, it's going to have to do with sensor placement and how the sensors are reading, because as we all know, garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
And if you have sensors that are not getting the right readings, or the readings are skewed or off for whatever reason, well, your result is not going to be optimal.
Yeah, it seems like the future looks really interesting when you combine precise environmental control with machine learning over time.
Yep.
That's going to be good.
But it still needs some tweaking. What I learned early on when we were playing with VPD in grow rooms, asked about, well, how does the plant express itself if your VPD is too high or too low? And then it came back to, well, those are the same symptoms as too much or too little nutrient in the plant.
Yes.
Well, and then it was like, well, wait, if your VPD is too high, the plant's going to take up more nutrients. So you're overfeeding the plant. So now is it the result of your ratio of nutrients to water, or do you fix your VPD to get it in place and then fix? But both of those, the plant expresses in its tips of the leaf and color and stuff similarly. So an AI, you know, is it going to adjust the nutrient level, or is it going to adjust the VPD level? Because either one of them can cause a similar result if you're not. And that requires, to some degree, a good farmer who talks to his plants and is going to walk in there and goes, hey, girls, you're happy, or you don't look happy today. Yeah, what's your problem? Yeah. And they know. They'll know, right, this is what we need to tweak. And so they can tweak it and then teach the AI a lesson.
That's a good point. Yeah, because it's hard to replace that industry knowledge, that crop knowledge, that decades and decades of experience being in a grower, you know, that's not something you can easily translate. You know, it's a lot of it is instinctual, but over time you have a gut call, like, and they are living things and you're engaging with them as living things. And I think that's important to remember.
Yeah. It's just this past weekend, being a bit of a science and food nerd, went to an Alton Brown show, who's the celebrity, and he spoke about AI can't cook. And it was great. He, you know, took 100 index cards of various ingredients, mixed them up, pulled out 10 and said to AI, okay, give me a recipe using these 10 ingredients. It was hysterical, you know?
Yeah, I can't imagine what turned out. So where is an industry or application where you think this technology will show up next that people wouldn't expect?
And you know, in post-harvest, we're looking at tea.
Oh, yeah.
It's fascinating. You know, starting to look at tea as, you know, white tea, green tea, black tea. And then we learn it's all the same plant. And what differentiates them is the steps during post-harvest.
Yeah.
And a lot of these steps that have been going on for hundreds, thousands of years, and we're watching it, it's going, oh, we thrash it. Oh, no, you're not. You're breaking the trichome heads. So that could be a very interesting world for us to really start to explore next. But for us, the most exciting part is watching the cannabis industry start to realize that, yes, there's been so much work done growing the plant and yet nothing done on post-harvest.
Yeah. So I'm curious about your kind of day-to-day. You probably wear a lot of hats in your role as CEO, and there's always challenges, as there are with any exciting project like the one you're working on now. What's a tough question you've had to ask yourself recently?
Well, first, thank you for the promotion. That's CEO, COO. The tough question is, how do we get the legacy folks to embrace change? And what we see is so many people who are doing really well with their legacy methods, who can do much better, are afraid of change to a degree, because they're not 100% sure why what they're doing is working, you know, because it might not all be backed in science. It's back to, you know, that touchy-feely, the farmer feeling. But here we've got more science going for you to get you more repeatable and consistent results.
Yeah. So for someone listening who's a grower, an operator, or a producer, what's the one thing you'd want them to rethink about their current process?
To see what current science is available. And there are science in other industries that have been around for a really long time are proven and work. For example, water activity, the food industry for decades, the pharmaceutical industry for decades, even museums look at water activity to make sure their rare documents aren't devoured by mold. Yet in the cannabis world, people are still talking about percent moisture, and it really is not a good unit of measure to know you have shelf-stable product. So it's shifting away from those legacy methods and going into the more solid science of this.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I really appreciate your team, again, like I said, reaching out and this deep dive into understanding, you know, a lot of things about this growing process. Is there, you know, obviously you've got your hands full with Cannatrol, but as a tinkerer and as a scientist and as someone who likes to learn new technologies, are there other things that you're kind of working on in the back shed? While you're thinking new ideas all the time, I imagine.
Right now, it's here. This is all consuming, but it's different platforms and different configurations of the technology to fit different market segments.
Yeah.
You know, so we have our Cool Cure home grow unit, which is good for the home grower. It'll take a plant of about a little over 2 pounds, 2.5 pounds. And then we got our first, you know, kits. But those start at about 160, 180 pounds. So we're coming out with products to fill that gap, which is going to be more targeted to, let's say, the social clubs in Germany, to people who have larger home grow. So that's where a lot of our time is right now, to get all of these new products out the door.
So you do have a unit for a home grower or a solo home grower?
Yes, that's our Cool Cure unit.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Yeah, and we've shipped those all over the world.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure that people who might want to try their hand at the tech, that'd probably be a good place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, David, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation. Where's the best place for folks to learn more and to connect with you?
If they go to our website, cannatrols.com with an S, we have lots of white papers and scientific information. So when we say it's better, we won't say it's better unless we have technical documents that prove, you know, prove and explain what the outcome is and why we can say it's better. That's all on our website. We're also on all the social media platforms, LinkedIn, and you know, the whole round of them. We're there.
Yeah. We'll make sure all those links are in the show notes. Thanks again for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation and for sharing your insights with our audience.
It's great. And I look forward to meeting again.
Likewise.
Thanks.
$680 million poured into Precision Ag last year. Autonomous weeding robots dominated. And John Deere made two acquisitions in 3 months. A food company, not an equipment maker, bought a robotics startup to protect its own supply chain. The deals are accelerating, the money is moving, and the winners are already separating from the pack. If you're investing, building, or buying in this space, you need the full picture before your competitors get it. The 2025 Precision Agriculture Intelligence Report from iGrow News is now available. Get your copy today at igrownews.com/precision.